Hello?
Hello? Hello? Hello? From now, you decide you want to buy a new house, and I wanted to know, well, how important would Testing. Oh, there it is. Okay. We'll try. Oh, my God. But now it's delicate. If I touch it, it's liable to not work anymore. So what do I do? We'll see if we can make this work. Okay. So the Twitter card question, 20 years from now, you're buying a house. I ask you on a scale of 1 to 10, how important would issues of climate be? Where 10 is incredibly important, and one is not important at all. So here are some of the responses. Here are a couple of tens. Someone says, it's very important to me because I feel guilty every time I use the air conditioner, even in my apartment here. So much so that wait a second. Okay. I can't hold this damn thing and read at the same time. So much fossil fuel is burnt just for my comfort, and I feel bad about it. Okay, someone else also said 10, and their explanation is, with regards to our planet, we are running out of ways to find cheap, clean energy. The sun is our best possible way to find a type of energy and should be utilized to the maximum extent. Then some people said, okay, not 10 quite, but 9. So someone says, not only is it expensive to keep an energy inefficient house, it's also very uncomfortable. My room used to be on the west side of the house, and I was miserable year-round because of the hot Austin sun that made the room 100 degrees no matter what. There was no shading on a huge window. Okay, so just, you know, for any kind of comfort, you need to pay attention. Here's another 9. Someone says, I care about natural cycles and solar heating because it is beneficial to the environment and it's cost effective. I would love to alter everything about my life to be eco-friendly, but I know that changing my lifestyle completely may be almost impossible. This is one thing you could do that's pretty identifiable. Okay, then some people were more like, I don't know, maybe a 6. Someone says, I think solar efficiency is important, but I would only rank it as a 6. It isn't the most important because while a solar house may do an okay job of heating and cooling, I would probably always want to adjust the AC exactly like I want it anyway. Someone else says a 5. They say, these responses to climate are about a 5. Yes, I would like a green home so I can save the earth and my wallet, but if it's going to cost me the aesthetic beauty of my home, then I'd rather not deal. In all honesty, most of the presented buildings look hideous from the outside, despite how green they are. Good point. Now, I have to tell you that may have been, I was trying to show you very didactic buildings where you could see the point. So they, some of them were pretty distorted and hideously ugly. I told you they were ugly. Today, we're going to look at a couple of projects that are equally climate responsive, but I don't think ugly. In fact, I think really quite beautiful, maybe. So just to make the point, maybe that was me last time not showing you exactly the right projects. Didactic projects, but maybe not so beautiful. So someone else says, I would say around a 4. Air conditioners have improved so much over the past few years that they're able to control the temperature nearly perfectly. My grandparents used to live without AC using some of these solar methods, but I was always slightly uncomfortable in their house. This is true of these passive solar houses. It's not like it's always 72 degrees. It's not. Sometimes it's 80. Sometimes it's 64. But that's the argument Lisa Hishong makes, saying, you know, actually, all this temperature variation, some of that's good for us. It actually is what our bodies were meant to do. But yeah, the passive solar houses are not exact. I think that gives a pretty good selection. Some people said, like, zip, nada, just give me my AC. That was okay, too. All right. So partly what this shows is the different values people have. We talked about that in an early lecture. What are your architectural values? And that's exactly what people were expressing here. What do they think is important in general in the world? How important is environmental responsibility? And so, oh boy, it clicked in big time then. So those values apply to architecture. How would you choose your house according to your values as a human being, as an individual, as relates to architecture? The Twitter card question today, again, is about values. So we're honing in here, pulling that values lecture into, now we've seen a lot of different issues in architecture. What's important? What's important to you? How would you want the physical environment to suit your needs as opposed to someone else? Okay, so today we're looking at an overview of physical considerations, and we're going to do like we did with the overview of form. We're looking at how a single building might deal with all of these things we've been talking about. So we're going to be looking at 3 buildings, each of them according to all of the issues we looked at in this segment of the course. And really, a lot of what architecture is about is not being a one-trick pony. Maybe that's what those passive solar houses were not so good at, is they were just a one-trick pony. But how do you pull these ideas together? How can it be really good in terms of relating to the land and be really good in terms of climate? How can it be really expressive of the structure and the materials and be very responsible about that, and at the same time be relating to geography, topography, and ecology? These are not exclusive things. It's good to kind of understand them by looking at them individually. But the real answer is that they happen concurrently. And really what happens the very best is synergy. So 1 and 1 equals 3. It's doing this and it's doing that, and because of that, it's doing even more. So that's really what we're looking at in the buildings today. So the first example we want to look at is a winery in the Napa Valley in California. It's called Dominus Winery. This is one of the foremost wine producing establishments in the world. Dominus is a very, very old label. It's a French label. And for generations, they had Dominus Winery in France. And they produce the premier wine in the world. This is super expensive wine. This is at all the contests. They win the contest. This is really premier wine. And they had been doing that in France, as I said, for generations. Then suddenly in all these wine competitions, they were not being the top. They were getting their ass beat by these California vintners. And this family was the Mouet family in France. They had a lot of pride, and they were just really pissed off that they weren't getting the top wines in the world anymore. So what they realized is that the Napa Valley in California has better soil, and has better climate for growing wine than France. Oh, shit. You know, poor Frenchmen, you know, all this time they've been producing this wine, and it turns out there are better soils and better climates for raising grapes for wine than in France. And one of those places is the Napa Valley in California. So Dominus Winery could either say, okay, well, we're always going to be second rate because we can only grow what we can grow in France, or we can make an outpost in the Napa Valley and we can start growing grapes there and produce wine from those grapes. And they made the decision, very hard decision, to make an outpost in the Napa Valley. And then they found just the right location with just the right soil and just the right climate to grow the kind of grapes they wanted for this particular kind of wine they were producing. This is physical considerations as related to winemaking. The art of winemaking is extremely dependent on physical considerations. If you don't have the right soil, if you don't have the right climate, if you don't have the right amount of sun, if you don't have the right amount of rain, you're not going to grow the right kind of grape and you're not going to have the right kind of wine. So these vintners understood the importance of physical considerations in the art of winemaking. So when I went to see Dominus Winery, I actually had the privilege of getting the tour with the architects, Herzog and Demeron, Jacques Herzog and Pierre Demeron, and Christian Mouet, who is the owner of Dominus Winery. And at first, I'm hanging out with the architects, and after a while, Christian Mouet pulls me off to the side, and he wants to give the tour. And what he's showing me is the soil and the grapes. He's, he lovingly pulls a cluster of grapes off of that plant and explains to me how this grape is getting exactly what it needs to have exactly the right flavor for him to make the wine out of, and how it's all about that soil. Okay, does this work? That's good. Much better. So building a building for makes sense. An architect. a river that goes through the valley. There is one. The river and the hills are very linear. The rocks out of the soil. The building, the proportion of the building, the materials of the building, all of the the of his long valley, the rows of grapes are in linear direction, and the material of Taliesin West that we looked at in that lecture. Then the second lecture we had on geography, topography, ecology, and we were looking at issues of flooding and erosion and all of those things that are physical considerations in this building. So one is the soil. They came back the next morning. If the mouse was gone, the mesh was too big. If the mouse was still there, the mesh was fine. So they experimented with a few mice, lost a few, and figured out exactly what density of mesh they needed. But in the end, protected the wildlife and separated the wildlife from the activities going on inside. This is all physical considerations. Okay, so we looked at relating the building to the land. We looked at geography, topography, ecology. We had a lecture later about more internal physical considerations like structure and materials. So we looked at two different kinds of structural systems in that, bearing systems and bending systems. Bearing systems being totally in compression, bending systems being in bending. That is a combination of tension and compression. And this building has both of these. There's some areas that have bearing walls, and they're made out of concrete. And for certain functions, like when you need a wine cellar, you need a completely enclosed space that is just meant to keep that wine there. That's a really good structural system for it, just a bearing wall, a solid bearing wall. But then there are other areas where you're loading and unloading goods, you're maneuvering the trucks, areas where you might want a view or a breeze, and there you might need more a bending system where you had more openness. And so we have the bending system, and of course the material is different. The material is steel for the bending system. So we have bearing systems in concrete, bending systems in steel, and we can see that in the joists that are going across here, in the beams, and in the columns that are going through here. And in the building, you see the difference between the wine cellar down here with its bearing wall, and this is the administrative offices up here with their frame and their openness. And we're in the corridor right up there looking out, and you can see that explicit steel frame structural system, very logically applied, very appropriate for the uses within. So if you've got a big vault where the wine is fermenting, that's the bearing system, and it's concrete, and that's what that looks like on the outside. If you have other kinds of functions that need a bending system, that's applied equally well. Okay, so we looked at structural system. Then we also had a lecture on construction, the actual construction process. Again, super important here, because you don't want to screw up that very valuable soil and landscape that's there. So you want to have the minimum intrusion of the construction process on this valuable land. So, you know, they don't do any site preparation. There's no bulldozers moving the land around. Luckily, it's flat to begin with, so that was good. And then there's no, like, exotic foundation here, because they're trying to interrupt the land as little as possible. And they just pour a slab on the grade, no basement, no elaborate dealing with that there. And so you just lay the slab on the ground, and then you build the frame or the concrete walls, the structural system up from that. In those steps that we talked about in that lecture, you build the frame, and then you build enclosure. In this case, we have the gabions, the stones in cages there. And then you build the partitions, which are non-load-bearing, these glass partitions, and they're separating off the offices and the workspaces from the corridors and the passageways. And then you start putting on the finish materials, this little gauzy finish ceiling that lets you see up in and see the technology, but have a kind of closure to it as well. Things like that, nice wood handrail details, finishes, and that completes the building. Very easy to see the whole construction process there as well. And then some really exotic bits of finished material, these beautiful dark green glass doors, and some lovely details they added to it as well. So it deals with the construction process. Then finally, we had the lecture on climate, and this building is super duper amazingly climate responsive. Okay, it happens that nice coincidence that the Napa River in this particular area is running east-west. So when you build a long river, a long building parallel to the river, it has its long faces north and south and its short faces east and west, which of course is just the right proportion. And then the height of the building is just about the same as its width. So there again, we get that almost perfectly ideal proportion of the mass of the building in order to be climate responsive. So massing was one thing we talked about there. A second thing we talked about was fenestration. Now, many of the areas here don't need any fenestration. You don't want windows in that those big vault spaces where you're fermenting the wine. But you do definitely want windows in the office area up here. And so all of the windows are either facing north or south. Those were the ideal orientations. Absolutely no windows facing east and west. And then where you do have south-facing apertures, then there is solar shading, horizontal solar shading, that's helping to protect so that the sun comes in the wintertime, comes in much less in the summertime. So, damn, they are just following textbook rules. The massing of the building is almost perfect. The fenestration is exactly in the optimal place. And then the solar shading helps that fenestration perform in the maximum benefit to the building. Okay, so then we also, in climate, we talked about storage of heat. And this building is what we'd call a high thermal mass building. You think, well, why did they make an exterior material that is all those heavy rocks? Obviously, the stone is not creating a water barrier in the skin. But what it is doing is it's creating a great deal of thermal mass. So what they're dealing with here is there is a very high diurnal swing in the Napa Valley. I think I mentioned what diurnal swing means. That means the difference between daytime temperature and nighttime temperature. So in the Napa Valley, you would often have a 40 degree, 50 degree diurnal swing. It might be 90 degrees during the day, but it might get to 40 degrees at night. So what they're doing is making high thermal mass so that during the day, the sun would shine on those rocks. It would heat those rocks up. They're heavy. They would hold that heat. And then at night, when it goes down to 40 degrees, it's re-radiating that heat back into the building to keep that wine from getting too cold, because you want the wine right about 64, 65 degrees. So it's heating it up so it doesn't get to be 40 degrees at night. And then by the time the sun comes out the next morning, those rocks have cooled off. They act as a shadow device so that they're collecting the heat on the outside, but it takes a while for that heat to radiate into the inside of the building. And just about the end of the day, they've acquired enough heat that it's beginning to push heat into the interior spaces. So at night, the high thermal mass is warming the building. During the day, the high thermal mass is shading the building and keeping the heat of the sun out of it. So that big, heavy, it's a concrete wall on the inside, it's gabions with rocks on the outside, all of that amazing amount of mass is stabilizing the temperature, and with almost no conditioning, no air conditioning, no heating, the building keeps that wine at 64, 65 degrees year round. Now, Herzog and Demeron told the client, we don't want to put an air conditioning or heating system in the building. It's going to do it all by itself. You don't have to worry about it. This climate is so great that we can manage that even temperature without a mechanical system. And Christian Mouet said, I'm just too nervous about that. I don't want my wine getting screwed up. If there's a huge heat wave and it's 105 degrees for 20 days in a row, you know, is it still going to work? Are you certain? So they put in a heating and air conditioning system. I was there about a year after the building had been in operation, and they had never turned on the heating and the air conditioning. But it's there if, in fact, there were an extreme climate condition where they needed it. Otherwise, it's strictly passive performance. Now, I know some of those other buildings I showed last time, they were butt ugly. But this one I don't think is ugly. It's not conventional, but it's a very interesting, very, I think, sensory building. You feel every breeze when it comes off those vineyards as you're walking from your office to the restroom. We spent that afternoon walking around the building. It was just phenomenally pleasant thermally all the way through it. And in a very natural, very kind of California way. But you didn't feel any of that kind of heating and air conditioning there. It was all being done just naturally. So they're very extreme cases of these rooms where they store the wine or where they ferment the wine with these very heavy, massive walls, and they're like caves that which is where they used to put wine to ferment it, would be in the caves. Now they've made a cave to put it in that has all that high thermal mass. And those spaces are very different from the spaces up above, which are for offices, and they have a completely different thermal environment there. Now, the day that I was there, we spent a fair amount of time, I don't know if I can find that slide, right there at this little conference table. It's an outdoor conference room because, you know, it doesn't get super hot in the Napa Valley during the day, so most of the year they'd be able to use just that outdoor conference room. And this was actually in, like, November, December. And so you can see the sun is fairly low and there's a lot of heat gain that's being gotten here. And so even though it might have been a high of 70 that day, it was actually pretty pleasant because there was all that sun that was shining, heating up that concrete and re-radiating it back into even the outdoor spaces there. So, we're doing business out there in an outdoor conference room, beautifully conditioned by natural forces. Another thing that was just incredible, we were there late in the day and the sun was going down, and these gabions, sometimes when you're inside you see through the rocks that are in the wire cages and you see the light coming through, and it's actually quite a nice, interesting light effect. But where we're standing right here, just opposite that, there's a glass wall, a completely glass wall. And late in the day, the sun was way down low, and it went kind of horizontally through those gaps in the rocks and made little sparkles of light on the glass. And so it was really kind of cool seeing the light on the glass like that. But then just as the sun began to go below the mountain, oh my God, it was like, you know how in an eclipse, when there's a solar eclipse and you have a piece of cardboard and you prick a hole in it and the light goes through there and what you see on the ground is the eclipse. You see the circle, but you see a little crescent taken out of it. It was doing the same thing with those little bits of light coming through, but as the sun went below the hill, it had that little crescent taken out of it. So instead of seeing little circles of light, we were seeing little crescents of light on there. It's just like this building is keyed into the universe and nature and light in a kind of beautiful, really moving way. So I'm making the argument, if you make a building, start to finish, and you take all of these physical considerations into your design, and you do it very seriously, there can actually be a kind of poetry that comes out of that, a kind of synchronicity with the landscape, with nature, with air, with light, that is really very beautiful. And I think it's not so much, this is not a building to be seen as an image in a photograph. This is a building to be felt, to feel the air, to feel the sun, to smell, it's a sensory building because it's so keyed into all of these physical considerations. Okay, so I'm making a case here for a kind of beauty that comes out of really seriously dealing with physical considerations, as I think the Dominus Winery does. Okay, second building I want us to look at. This one is the Simpson Lee House. This is in Australia. It is out in freaking nowhere in Australia. It's maybe 90 miles from Sydney, west of Sydney, and it's out in the outback. And to get here, you just take dirt roads for miles and miles and miles. And in fact, when I went out there, we got, as the Australians say, we got bogged, which means that we got stuck. We, in Texas, we'd say stuck. They say bogged. But it was the road was muddy, and we got stuck and for hours. And we're in the middle of nowhere, and finally got somebody to come and pull us out when we got bogged. But anyway, it's very, very, very remote. And it is owned by, it was built by an economist, Mr. Lee. He's actually a pretty well-known, renowned economist. And he had taught for many years at University of Sydney, but he was semi-retired, and he wanted a place to go out and write, and just write books. So he lives here and just writes books, he and his wife. And because as an economist, his major concern is resource management. How do we in the world conserve resources? And he's an economist who says that we are profligate wasters of resources, and in the long run, this is not sustainable economically. So, of course, he wants to build a house that is very sustainable. And so this is meant to be a house that uses virtually no energy and really just lives with the minimum consumption of resources. Okay, so he's out in the middle of the forest, and it's a beautiful, beautiful spot, very good place to relax and write and think and be introspective and to live with a minimum footprint on the land. Glenn Murcutt, who is the architect, he talks about touching the earth lightly, buildings that just don't make a massive intrusion on the earth, but just touch the earth lightly in every way. So there's a hillside that goes through here. This is one of Glenn's sketches of the building. And the topography is running this way, sloping down that way. So the building is laying into the lines of the topography there, long and thin. And in terms of, again, that first lecture, it slips very gently into the landscape. They cut no trees, although it's in a forest. There was a little clearing here. There was a big rock outcropping down here. And so they were really trying to put the house between that rock outcropping and another rock outcropping here. But because there were big rock outcroppings, there were no trees exactly that spot. The rock also gave really good foundation, so they didn't have to really do much to the land to just anchor the building right straight into the rock. So there is the house itself here and a little studio over here, and there's a body of water between that we'll talk about in a minute. But you can see the lines of the topography going this way, sloping down in that direction, and this is the north arrow. This is the north side, south side of the building. This is meant to be really living with nature and in nature. So the house really opens up completely to the outdoors. There are sliding glass panels. And in this photograph, three panels, one that went here and one that went here, they've slid back and they're nested right there. There also would be screens. So a screen panel there and a screen panel there that also slide back here. And the same thing happens on the other side. So there's about 50 feet of just completely open space where the indoors and the outdoors merge together. And then you can either put the screens that keep the bugs out, or you can put the glass that keeps the temperature variation out, but the building just opens up completely to the landscape. And there we are on the inside, just looking out, no glass, no nothing, just a tiny little rail that connects the indoors and the outdoors together. So honestly, when you're sitting in that living room, it's almost like sitting outdoors, except that it's completely conditioned and sheltered and catches all the breezes and is extremely comfortable. Okay, so let's work through those same topics. In terms of fitting the building to the land, obviously fits with the contours. There even is this very, very tiny footprint on the land, basically very little impervious cover. The building is kind of up on stilts, so the ground just goes underneath the land like that. It was just made to have the least intrusion possible. It also is an area where there's not that much rainfall, so they're conscious of water here, and they're saving every little bit of water that comes down from the sky, and they do it in two different ways. There is this big roof, and as the rain falls on that roof, it drains back here. There's a gutter at that side. The gutter takes it to these tanks, and those tanks save the water and then filter it for domestic use. So for showering and for washing and for drinking, all of that is coming from water that's in those tanks right there. And then there also is an issue here of fires. Because it is relatively low rainfall, they have fires. They frequently have fires. And in fact, this forest is a eucalyptus forest, and eucalyptus forests need the fire. The eucalyptus seed actually doesn't germinate unless there's a fire. So what happens is the seed falls to the ground, then every so often there will be a fire. The fire bursts the seed, and that's what germinates the next generation of trees. So the fires are necessary in this forest. You're not trying to keep it from burning. You know it's going to burn. But then what if you put a house there and it burns down the house, like is happening in Smithville as we speak? So one thing you could say is, well, you should never build in the forest. And that's a very reasonable position to take. But maybe you need to or you want to build in the forest. So in this case, he built in the forest in a way that there could be a fire and it's not going to hurt the house. So what he did was he collected all the water from the hillside here. So the roof is sloping here and giving clean water there. But the hillside is sloping down here and gathering in a tank right there. And that water is not super clean. It's, of course, it's got a filter that keeps the too much of the muck from going down here. But basically, it's almost like a little pond, a little man-made pond that's right there. And when there's a fire, that water is piped up to the roof, and there are sprinklers up there. Just like you have a fire sprinkler system that shoots down in a house, this one has a fire sprinkler system that actually covers the entire house in a film of water when there's a fire event. So if the temperature gets to a certain level and it's clear there's a fire, then it sets off that sprinkler system and the entire house is enveloped in water. And in fact, that's so effective, they've had dozens of fires in the life of this house, and they've never had a problem a single time. And in fact, there's a house of a neighbor nearby, and they pipe water over the neighbor from their tank because they have an excess amount of water. So other people have started, I couldn't build my house so it doesn't get burned in the fire. Because fires happen in forests. That's a natural occurrence. And it's something maybe we could learn some of that lesson in the United States instead of just saying, oh, there shouldn't be fires in forests. Of course, there have always been fires in forests. And in some ways, in fact, one of the things in our national forests now that are a real problem is because we don't have fire for a long time and all the underbrush grows up really, really, really thick so that when there is a fire, there is so much fuel for that that it really gets so hot it burns the trees. Whereas a normal forest fire, a healthy one, there hasn't built up all that underbrush, and the underbrush can burn out, but the fire never gets so hot that it actually damages the tree itself. That's the natural way of having a fire in a forest. But if we prevent the fire for long enough, then the natural fire can't happen anymore. And it gets to be so hot, it burns the trees. So they've actually said, no, we're going to have the natural condition of the forest, and we're going to build in it, but we're going to build in a smart way that makes it all work together. Okay, so let's talk about structure a little bit. Obviously, you could tell already, this one is, you know, it's a frame building. It's a bending structure. And we see the columns, and we see the beams. And one of the things, because it was so remote, they made it out of lots of little bitty pieces of steel, not massive pieces of steel, because they wanted everything brought in a pickup truck, because they didn't want to have the intrusiveness of a big 18-wheeler, badass big truck coming in there. So everything was made out of smaller pieces that could be brought in a pickup truck and erected not by a crane, but by human labor. So all of it's these little pieces of steel. It's very interesting, you know, that big roof, like you see there. The load on that is not actually gravity load. The load you have to worry about is uplift. When a wind comes like that and it acts like a sail and it wants to go up. So the structural members in that area are actually tension members that are tying the roof back down here. And you see these really delicate, thin pieces of steel that are all that's required to hold those tension loads. So never is anything bigger than it has to be to carry the load. So at the bottom, you get the concrete as it makes a foundation for the building. And then above that, you get the bending structure, some of it in bending and some of it actually in tension because it's holding the roof down. And really, the architecture is coming significantly from that framing system, from those thin sheet of finished material of the roof, everything just the size it needs to be, no more resources, no more materials than necessary. Okay, in terms of climate response, you've probably already figured this out. Perfectly aligned. Long faces north and south, short faces east and west. That makes perfect sense. Breezes that just go through the house very easily and very naturally, oriented to the prevailing breeze that just gets cross ventilation through the house. Those enormous apertures open up so that you can catch every little bit of breeze that goes through there. The deep, deep overhang on the south side gives you then just the right cutoff so that you get the sun in the wintertime and you keep the sun out in the summertime. It would get to be fairly cold in a rural area here. It's a little bit of altitude that goes with this. So they did have to worry about getting that solar gain in the wintertime. They also have the only heating in the house is this big fireplace, but it's a mega fireplace. So originally in the United States, when the colonists came, they had fireplaces, and then they improved it at a certain point by having the Franklin stove that Benjamin Franklin invented. And it was cast iron, and the cast iron was really good for more efficiently radiating the heat of the fire out to the house. And so the fireplace here is that little bar right there, which is made out of steel, thick, thick plates of steel painted red. And that fireplace, when you build a fire in that, when it heats up that steel is super efficient in radiating it, just like a cast iron stove is, or a Franklin stove, into the rest of the house. And in fact, they have a little bit of ducted area where they take some of that heat of the stove and take it to the bedrooms on either end. Just in every way, the house is meant to be in synchronicity with the earth, with the landscape, with the site, with the sun, with the breeze, with the forest fires, with everything that relates to physical considerations in this area. Okay. Third building. This one's a little closer to home. This is Rough Creek Lodge, which is in Glen Rose, Texas. That's kind of southwest of Fort Worth. This one was done in 1999. The owner of this, and again, in each of these cases, it's a client who cared about these issues. The owner of this was a crazy-ass guy whose name was John Adams, just like the president. And he had made a fortune in pharmaceuticals. He'd had several different companies that made drugs, and he built them up and sold them and made a ton of money, and then built another one up and sold it and made a ton of money, and he'd done that about three or four times. And he had, with part of his money, he bought a ranch in sort of north central Texas, and he loved his ranch. He loved the calm and the peace he felt when he was out in the landscape there. He just loved his ranch. And he believed that for people who were business people, corporate people, no matter what your business was, you needed that relief of nature. You needed to go out in the landscape and feel that de-stressing environment of his ranch. So he decided that he wanted to share that experience. So he bought the ranch next door, and he decided to make it a corporate retreat, a place where business people could come and have their meetings. It wasn't that far from DFW Airport, so his idea was people would come from all over the world, and they'd fly into DFW Airport, and then they'd go out to this beautiful landscape of north central Texas, and they'd have their business meeting out there, and they would decompress. And you know, that it's a little bit idealistic, and it didn't work out exactly that way, but it's a very peaceful place for anybody to go and just decompress, and that's the idea of it. So there was an old house on this ranch that had been built right there in the 19th century, but maybe, I don't know, 6 or 8 years before he bought it, the house had burned down. So there were some big old oak trees that had been around the house, and because they watered around the house, the oak trees had grown really, really big. So there were beautiful big oak trees around the side of the house, but the house was gone. So the decision was made to build